Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Sometime in the next month, a baby will be born, an umbilical cord cut, and the population of the United States will hit 300 million. It's been a long time coming since this was a vast continent of teepees and forest trails. But now, uniquely among the world's richest nations, America's population is surging. Only India and China are bigger. We hit 200 million in 1967, 300 million any day now, and 400 million is projected in less than 40 years. On the emptying Great Plains, they may be wondering, where's the boom? But on the coasts, the South and West, Americans are living it. Up next on Point, the U.S. population at 300 million and what that number means for the country. We'll jump in today with two well-known demographers who've been watching the U.S. population for a long time. From Ithaca, New York, we're joined by Martha Farnsworth Ritchie. She's a fellow at the Center for the Study of Economy and Society at Cornell University. She's former director of the U.S. Census Bureau. Martha Farnsworth Ritchie, thanks so much for being with us.
I'm happy to be here.
And from Ann Arbor, Michigan, we're joined by William Fry. He's a visiting fellow at the Brookings Institution and research professor at the Population Studies Center at the University of Michigan. William Fry, thank you for joining us.
Good to be with you, Tom.
You have imagined this 300 millionth American, where they'll be born, who, what, when. Describe how you picture it.
Well, I may have gone out on a limb a little bit with this, but I have put this 300 millionth American as a male baby born in Los Angeles County, a Mexican born to an immigrant mother, and I've pinpointed October the 17th as the day when it will happen. I wouldn't bet a lot of money on that, but
Wizard's hat, and how do you come up? October 17th, we can imagine that's just a calculation, but male of a Mexican immigrant mother in Los Angeles, why do you aim there?
Well, about half of the population growth in any year or in any month in the United States is Hispanic, and we know that they're in the growth of the population. About 40% of the growth is due to immigration. About 60% is due to natural increase, although many of those babies are born to immigrant parents. Los Angeles County is where the biggest numeric gains are in the Hispanic population, and so I put that all together. And, of course, there are more male babies born than female babies, slightly more. And putting all that together, that's how I came up with that scenario.
Martha Farnsworth Ritchie, take us into to this number. It's not so long ago that people talked about zero population growth. 1967, the country hit 200 million. Now it's 300. We're reading that by 2043, it could be 400 million. But just look at where we are about to arrive today. Has this been baked in the cake for a long time? Was it clear we were going to 300 million? Is there any surprise to a demographer here?
I think if you take the long view, going back to that discussion a couple of decades ago about zero population growth, yes, there are some surprises here. I don't think we realized then, in fact, we're only beginning to realize, that the U.S. is different from all the rest of the developed countries in having this kind of population growth. I think people focus on what's going on in the world at large and assume that the U.S. is just like other developed countries, either growing very, very slowly or in many cases, like Japan or Germany or Italy, starting to look at population declines. I think most Americans aren't aware, and I don't think we saw it coming, that we would have this level of population growth. That said, that idea of zero population growth did assume, and we've always assumed, that we'd still have two children per family on an average, which we've had throughout most of the last century, absent the baby boom and the subsequent baby bust. And that's true. We're still having our average two kids per family. The rest of the developed world isn't. They're having much fewer, and that makes a difference there. The reason that we thought the idea of zero population growth did assume the kinds of births we're having, but it didn't realize, I don't think we realized how much life expectancy was going to keep on increasing in the U.S. That keeps more people in the population as a whole. And I don't think we forecast the kind of immigration we've been seeing.
So let's put some numbers on that, if we can, William Fry. Pop the hood on this thing and look at the engines of growth here. One is just that we're sticking around longer. So the population is growing older. When you look at the 300 million in percentage terms or however you like, what part do birth rates and immigration play beyond the boomers just sticking around?
Well, overall, the growth rate has immigration and what we call a natural increase components, and immigration accounts for about 40% of the growth in every given year. Now, there's also the fact that the natural increase, which includes births and deaths, many of those births come to immigrant parents. So there's this indirect impact. I think the immigration impact on this current growth and on the forecasted growth is huge, because we're going to continue to have these immigrants coming into the country, I believe, although it's a matter of policy debate, I guess. And with this constant flow of immigration, it will increase the pool of babies born to immigrants. So the number of second-generation Americans will become a large part of our population.
So immigration, too. Huge. I'm looking back on these numbers now. Immigrants is 12% of the total population today, as compared with in 1967, when we hit 200 million, it was 5% of the population. Italy, the leading country of origin then, Mexico today, that's going to ripple through for a long time. Martha, most of the births in that camp as well?
Well, what's happening in immigration is that, as you point out, the source of our immigrants is changing. And so when we look at other countries, when we look in the less developed countries, we see very large birth rates in many parts of the world. I think that tells us that we can continue to expect a lot of immigration, and that it will be continually different.
And are immigrants bringing those birth rates with them? That's what's keeping the American birth rate up above those of most countries in Europe?
Yes and no. It's the Hispanic immigrants who are bringing slightly higher fertility rates with them. And that is what one of the things that makes our country have the higher level of births than we're seeing in other developed countries. That's one of really two things. If we just looked at our white non-Hispanic population, our fertility rates would be the same as those in northern European countries like Sweden, like England, that have taken similar policy changes as we have in this country to make it easy for women to work and still have the two kids they say they want.
We're going to hear from the sort of economist view of what this 300 million number means, from an environmental view, but I just wanted to ask each of you, as demographers, William Fry, when you look at this, when demographers get together, is this a marvel? Is it amazing? Does it look like a healthy population for a country of this size physically, or a problematic population? Is there a range of views? What does 300 million mean?
Well, I think more than the number, we want to focus on how we got here. And this immigration component is very important. What it does is it brings youth to the United States. If we didn't have these immigrants coming in, we would have this aging, largely white population, especially with the baby boomers moving into the senior citizen ages, a sort of AARP generation. Yep. AARP loves it, but for the country as a whole, we need a more youthful labor force. We need to have a population which will help support these older folks. The second thing that immigration does is it brings more diversity, more race and ethnic diversity to the United States. This is something I think, which maybe some of our economist contributors will talk about, will affect us greatly in terms of connecting with other parts of the world in a global economy. The fact that we're moving back to a melting pot which we really didn't have for the last half of the 20th century, when we were mostly people born in the United States as our source of population growth. I think this will help us bode very well for the future, both to have a younger population and a more vibrant population coming from other parts of the world.
And Martha, we're talking here about a majority-minority nation, maybe in another 40 or 50 years. Have to recalibrate those terms. But what about, on balance, as you look at this as a demographer, the sort of pluses and minuses, costs and advantages of hitting this number?
I think it really comes down to choices that we make, and that's why it's important that the public understand that we really are in a different situation from all the other countries we normally deal with. Even Canada is in a vastly different situation with nothing like the kind of growth that we're seeing in the United States. Because it will force choices. It will force choices on things like where people move and live if they are going to areas that are vulnerable in terms of, say, water or hurricanes or places like that.
You're saying the sheer weight of population will have an effect on those choices.
Well, where they go will. As people in focus groups I've viewed will often say, well, we have plenty of room out in the Dakotas. If people want to move to the Dakotas and they want to spread around, that's fine. But population concentration in many ways is going to the south and the southwest, and that's putting people in areas that are both economically and environmentally vulnerable. So these are all things we can handle if we choose to have policies that will go in that direction. But those are choices that we will have to make changes.
Looking back, it was 1967 when the country hit 200 million. That was the era when color TV was the big deal. The Lucy Show, Andy Griffith, Gomer Pyle. Now it's the time of iPods, American Idol, cell phones, a whole lot of immigrants, and a changing face to this country. We've been joined from Ann Arbor, Michigan by William Fry, demographer there, from Ithaca, New York by Martha Farnsworth Ritchie at Cornell University. We're going to hear from an environmentalist in a few minutes, but first joining us from New York is Michael Mandel. He's chief economist at Businessweek magazine. He recently wrote an article for the magazine headlined, What It Means to Hit 300 Million. Michael Mandel, thanks for being with us. What does it mean economically?
Tom, I'm glad to be here. I think that the sort of moderate population growth that the U.S. has been having is actually a real plus from an economic and innovation point of view. As opposed to stagnation, you have a younger population, you have more dynamism, and the fact that, 300 million by itself is not a really significant number, but the fact that we're still growing and growing faster than the other industrialized countries, I think is actually one of the reasons why the U.S. has been a more innovative country in terms of on the growth side.
Not just because of the sheer number, but you're saying because we've got that means a younger population, a more adaptable population.
There's a little bit more flux going on. I think if you think about population, a country where population has topped off, it's going to be aging, especially in the early part. It's going to be a little bit sort of stagnant from the economic point of view as well. We don't really know what the full set of factors that go into being innovative is, but you just have this sense that being young is better.
Does it matter as a market, for the size of the market that 300 million present, or in an era of globalization, can you shrink and still feed a growing world market products, and so the home population doesn't matter so much?
Well, we're going to find that out, right? I mean, part of the reason behind the European common market was the idea that having a bigger market was a good thing. It may or may not have worked for them. It seems to be. It may not be a surprise that both China and India, who are the two countries that are larger than the U.S. in terms of population, have very dynamic economies. You just have this sense in the back of your mind that having a big market and one that's growing is a plus if you've got the other factors in place as well.
And what about the costs? I mean, we'll talk to an environmentalist, but as someone who looks at economics, what about the cost of that big population?
I don't really see it on the economic side. There's environmental costs, obviously, and I'm not going to get into debates about that.
Ultimately loop back to economic costs or not, in your view, Michael?
No, I don't. Well, I don't think so. I think, environmental costs are, it's a whole different debate altogether, and you can sort of ask the question about what the carrying capacity of the country is. But if you look at it from the economic point of view, say the need to buy to build new housing, you don't want to be growing fast in terms of population, and you don't want to be stagnant. Kind of this sort of slow but steady growth the U.S. has had seems to be a pretty good range, at least from my point of view.
So from an economics perspective, you'll give it a thumbs up. What about at a personal level, Michael? It also can mean traffic jams and all the rest.
I was just thinking about this question the other day as I was driving around New Jersey, which is
celebrating the 300 million,
which is where I live, and there's an awful lot of traffic there. But you know, the traffic seems to be much more connected with places where they're doing road construction projects. And what I think there is that if you get a bigger population, you end up having to sort of not only build new infrastructure, but you end up rebuilding your old infrastructure as well, which is something which is going to happen no matter what the population is. So in my mind, I'm not sure that the heavy population, the 300 million, really leads to that much more congestion and negativity from the economic point of view. Besides, we all seem to be clustering into the same areas. The concentration seems to be increasing.
And yet I wonder Americans still have in the back of their mind somewhere that picture of America as this kind of vast expanse of place to be in our lives. May not feel like that at 300 million or 400. I want to turn to our callers. Tom's calling from Des Moines, Iowa. Hi, Tom, you're on the air.
Hi, I'm originally from China, and we've been talking about the impact on the economy of this population growth. I think we've been talking about the positive side, like we have youthful population to replenish the aging population to support the retiring population, but we haven't talked about the quality of the people. So we've seen, noticed that the vast majority of the immigrants are Hispanic, and the vast majority of Hispanic population are living on the line of poverty. And Hispanic teenagers have the highest high school dropout rates. So I think the next course of America is to improve the education of the Hispanic population and the family and the children.
And Tom, there was a time when Chinese immigrants were impoverished, didn't have great education, and were not well received in this country. Do you see any reason to think that Hispanics will not ultimately, you know, blend in and contribute to the economy in the same way many Chinese have?
Yes. But the most on the Hispanic immigrants are, you know, they cross the border, and those illegal immigrants, they cross border. You have no control about their education or their skills. But on the other hand, those Chinese immigrants, I'm not talking about illegals. I'm talking about legals. Like they come here to go to universities to receive education. So
yeah, Tom, we've got it, and thanks for your call from Des Moines, Michael Mandel. I know we've got to let you go, but what do you say to that? Tom says, "Well, okay, let's look at the quality of this population in terms of education." He says, "How does that factor into an economist analysis?"
From my point of view, I think what I'm looking at is as much as energy as I am as in education. The people come, they come, and if they get absorbed into the country, they get educated. That's what the history has been. There's a big debate about what's been happening, not with Hispanics, but with Mexican immigrants, simply because they do flow back and forth across the border. But my feeling, and as I've written a lot about immigration, my feeling is that on net, the immigration is a plus, and that we as a country would be much more impoverished, both culturally and economically, if we cut it off.
Michael Mandel, chief economist at Businessweek. Thanks for being with us, Michael.
Oh, thanks very much.
William Fry, what about this changing face of the population in terms of in ethnic and country of origin? How do you see that playing out? I mean, clearly you can have cultural tensions there. We're seeing a lot in the immigration debate very recently. There are economic issues. How do you look at it as a demographer?
Well, I think if you look at the United States today, there's a big distinction between the race-ethnic structure of the people age 40 and over, the baby boomers and their seniors. It's largely a white-black population, mm-hmm. a population that sort of defined what we were for the last part of the 20th century, the white suburban middle class, as it were. But if you look at the under 40 population, and as you further go down in the ages, you get a much more diverse Hispanic, Asian, multi-race population, mm-hmm. much more interracial marriage, much more interracial dating. Now, there can be clashes. I think we've seen this with the recent immigration debate. As more new immigrants have moved out into the heartland, as it were, you see the congressional representatives of these areas coming to Washington trying to do something with respect to a more punitive kind of immigration measures. But I think this will be a short-term issue. I think overall, and in the long term, there will be a realization by everybody that having this growth of a younger population to help us in the labor force, whether they be whatever country they're from, will be a net plus for us. And I do think, though, with respect to the caller's question, that we do need to pay a little bit of attention from the federal level into how we help to assimilate these new immigrants coming in from different places, making sure they have that opportunity to get that education to get them into the middle class. That's part of it's a different topic, but it's part of a comprehensive immigration issue and reform that I think we need to address.
Martha Farnsworth, Richie, what about this changing ethnic makeup? We're looking here at projections that say white Americans may comprise just about half of the population by the time we hit the 400 million mark. Do you see cultural upheaval baked into that? We've already got the Minutemen down on the border. Or do you see the country positioned to absorb and, you know, sort of roll on, taking that cultural, that ethnic change in stride?
If you look back at the 1890s, early 1900s, when we had even more immigrants proportionally than we do now, and from places that seemed just as exotic to the folks who were here, even if they don't to us today.
Germany.
Italy, Greece, those were that was actually a big matter of concern, and we had riots in the country. We got past that. We'll get past it again. But going back to the argument we just heard, the economic argument we just heard, we actually do have evidence on what is the demographic relation to innovation. It isn't that younger people are more innovative than older people. We find just as much creativity and hard work amongst older people, albeit in different ways. It's having the diversity. It's having the combination of people who are different because they have to work harder, the research tells us, to communicate with each other and to persuade each other, and in doing that, they come up with more solutions.
But Japan is about as undiverse as you can get, and they've had a pretty good economic thing going for a while.
Yes, but remember that what they've done is adapted innovation that came from other countries, largely the United States.
Let me get a call from Columbia, South Carolina. Chris, you're on the air.
Hey, how y'all doing?
We're good. What do you see, Chris?
Well, I drive a truck, so I see a good bit of the road every day.
Mm-hmm.
Mainly in the southeast, I heard one of y'all comment on that a while ago, and that's true. It's growing like leaps and bounds, especially in Florida, around the Daytona area.
Does it look good? Does it look manageable? Does it look like too much?
It's total chaos. I mean, it's just a pain in the neck, you know, kind of maneuver through that every day, and it's just getting harder to deal with. It's supposed to be another million trucks on the road by in like 2009.
And 20 more million Americans in the country just since the year 2000. And Chris, from his truck window, sees total chaos in that number. Let me turn to New Canaan, Connecticut, and Victoria Markham, environmental scientist, director of the Center for Environment and Population based in New Canaan. Victoria, thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. I'm happy to be here.
So there's our friend, the truck driver, Chris. He looks out his truck window. He thinks about this population. He sees total chaos out there. As an environmentalist, how do you look at this 300 million mark and the 400 million to come?
Well, I think your caller really hit the nail on the head in that this growth is not without its significant environmental impacts. And the U.S. does stand out as the only industrialized nation with significant population growth in the world. And that, combined with our very high rates of natural resource consumption, is quite a volatile mix. It results in our country having the largest environmental impact per capita in the world. So we are basically, we've become a supersized kind of a metro nation with supersized appetites for land, water, and natural resources. And this plays itself out in various ways with regard to environmental impacts across the country.
Well, is it manageable? Is it manageable now? What about another 100 million? Is this an environmental fiasco in the making, even as our GNP may be ticking up or not?
Well, I think what's happening is that we are seeing some ecological limits being reached, in particular by the amount of natural resources that we are consuming and the pollution that results from that. Some examples, I can give you a list of examples, one of which is water. I mean, in many areas of the United States, we are withdrawing water faster than it can be replenished. A good example of that is the Ogallala Aquifer. It's the largest groundwater system in the U.S., but it's being withdrawn at rates that far exceed its capacity to recharge. So that's an example of how it may not on the surface look as if the population is having a major environmental impact in some regards, but it really is. It's affecting our water supplies.
And yet, you know, we've heard that argument for such a long time, and still in the demographic projections I'm looking at here, Phoenix, Tucson are projected to maybe merge into one giant megalopolis down there in the desert country. So where does nature's restraint finally come in and put a line around that growth, or does it?
Well, you know, I think your example was a really good one, because we found that the south and the western regions of the U.S. are, in fact, their population environmental hotspots. And the Phoenix area is a good example. It's the fastest growing, the west is the fastest growing region and the most populous region in the U.S. And with that comes highest energy use, highest water use, and also risk to plants and animal species there. So it definitely has its impacts, and it demonstrates the population trends that are happening in the country now. We have become a suburban nation. 4 out of 5 people now live in the suburbs. And as a result, there are land use changes that are unprecedented. Sprawl is the most predominant form of land use change now in the country. And that has major impacts on habitat loss, resulting species loss. Also, our sprawl form of living now, which is so common because of population growth, results in much more vehicle use, and transportation is the fastest growing energy sector. And as a result, the U.S. is disproportionately, you know, we're 5% of the world population. However, we represent 25% of CO2 emissions in the world. So we are the greatest contributor to global climate change because of our resource consumption here in the U.S. So,
and more of us coming every minute. Martha Farnsworth Ritchie, I wonder, when you were director of the U.S. Census Bureau, is it any part of the job there to look at this issue of carrying capacity, or is this just kind of a free market thing, grow and prosper? Is there a number that sits in a vault somewhere that says this is the maximum number of inhabitants that this continent can support?
People in our field have reviewed all of the estimates that a variety of people have made, and there's a huge range as to what is the ideal population size. And the answer is, it depends. It depends on what kind of lifestyle you want to have. One of the arguments that the guy made who compared all these estimates, he said, if your idea of a nice Sunday afternoon is to put the kids in the car and take them for a drive in the country, you may not like having more congestion, more pollution, higher gas costs, and so on and so forth. But if you don't mind living in an apartment and walking to work, that's not going to affect you. So it really comes down to lifestyle, and then that comes down to cost.
David's calling from Lexington, Massachusetts. Hi, David. You're on the air.
Hi, Mr. Ashbrook.
Sir.
Governor Schwarzenegger's program to reduce greenhouse emissions in California is doomed because of the population boom there.
He's just going to be overwhelmed. Can't keep up with with the numbers.
And likewise, although the U.S. as a whole should be doing the same thing, we're doomed unless we stabilize the population. The whole problem of greenhouse gases is aggravated by immigration because most of the immigrants that come to this country come from countries that produce far less greenhouse emissions per capita. And I want to point out that Mr. Fry's method of looking at how much of our population growth is due to immigration is flawed.
Why? How so?
Because the children of immigrants should be counted. If their parents hadn't immigrated, they wouldn't be born here. And I looked carefully at the growth in the United States during the 1990s. During the 90s, we grew by the population of equivalent of four New Jerseys. Three of those New Jerseys were due to mass immigration.
So David, I want to put this to my guest, but let me just ask you, what would you do? Would you close the border? Would you have a one-child policy? Is it that severe a challenge in your view?
I think there are more. I would limit immigration to 100 or 200,000 a year. I don't want to cut it off entirely because I think there are some benefits.
That would be cutting it way down. Let me put this to our guests. First, Victoria, if I may, to you on the environmental front. The caller says, look, our efforts to clean up the environment, to stay ahead perhaps of global warming, they're doomed because the population's growing so fast and we're high-consuming Americans. We're not running fast enough to get ahead of it. What do you say to that?
Well, I would say, you know, your statement with regard to that is correct. U.S. population growth, of which 60% is from natural increase, that's births minus deaths of people that are already here, and 40% from immigration. You know, it is definitely threatening the efforts that are being made, there's so many positive efforts being made in the U.S. California is one, Portland, Oregon's another example of a city that's making huge efforts. But I do believe it's a case of one step forward and two steps back because of our relatively fast-growing population and particularly coupled with our very high rates of resource consumption, it is causing to reverse some of our gains. So I think it is a huge factor. But I think
Does that mean the word doomed was used? Does the effort to get ahead of global warming, CO2 emissions, and all the rest, is it sort of baked in the cake that it will fail because it can't keep up with population? Or is there a more rosy picture than that out there somewhere?
Oh, I mean, I would say absolutely not. It's not doomed. I mean, you know, Americans are a can-do nation. I mean, what we need to do now is, you know, at this 300 million mark, it's a fantastic opportunity. Take a step back, take stock of our nation, look at how it is growing, look at what it is, and look at the environmental impacts because of resource consumption, and we can definitely do something about it. There's lots of ways that we can address it. We are a leader in so many ways, and we can be a leader in taking responsibility for the impacts. We can go back to the international arena and lead the process in, let's say, the Kyoto process. We can also support international family planning and those of the people in the U.S. who want to use family planning.
There's a lot we could do, but they're going to have to do it in spades, I guess, to stay ahead of that population wave. William Fry, what about our caller's challenge on the immigration front? You've discussed what you see as some of the positive aspects of that. Is there a downside?
Well, there is, of course. I mean, I think one of the big issues we have with the growth due to immigration is up until now it's been fairly clustered. Seven states have gotten the lion's share of all of these immigrants, and they tend to pile up in places like Los Angeles and New York and Miami. They're starting to disperse, but not in very large numbers yet. And I think part of what will play out, not only for immigrants but for the rest of the population, is both a declustering to parts of the country that aren't really very heavily populated yet, and there aren't large areas like that, and also some more of these kind of smart growth proposals where anti-sprawl kinds of measures that can take the form of local and state policies can help with that. And of course, going back and looking at our immigration law, again, I think we're going to have a lot of experimentation with our immigration policy over the next 10, 20, 30 years, not necessarily on the number of immigrants, but the priorities of immigrants coming here, what kinds of jobs they'll be able to fill, what kinds of niches they'll fulfill in our economy. Mm-hmm. And I think when we look at all of that, it'll take a little bit of time. I don't think we have to raise our hands and say, oh, we're doomed because we have all these immigrants coming in right now.
You've said, though, that you're concerned about income inequality and class divisions as the population grows. Why?
Well, I think it can be the case when you have a lot of immigrants, many of them coming from countries that are poor, many of them, the immigrants themselves, not having a high school education. piling up in selected school districts across the country. It poses a great challenge for those places. I think this needs to be addressed at a federal level so that there can be resources given to these places, providing the adequate training, providing the adequate roadmap for people to be able to move into the middle class. And as long as we have this kind of balkanized immigration policy, that is, until we have a strong federal immigration policy that deals with the issues of illegal immigrants, that deals with the issues of resources to places that get a lot of immigrants, there will be this clumping of immigrants in certain places, and those places will bear the burdens of trying to educate the second and third generation. It'll be a tough one. So I think we need to deal with all of that and also deal perhaps with looking a little more at the skill levels of immigrants who come to the United States as part of our preference system. Right now, about 80% of the immigrants who come to the U.S. come through family reunification rather than explicitly recognizing what kinds of jobs they might take.
Let's take a call from a part of the country where I'm guessing this population growth and clumping is not happening. From Hettinger, North Dakota, we're joined by Chris Showers. Chris, thanks for being with us. So we're hearing about population growth and a whole lot more to come, but we've also heard a lot about depopulation out in your neck of the woods. How's it look to you? Do you see any sign of the population boom?
I guess what we see out in the agricultural portions of the western Dakotas is that we see more of our young people leaving and probably haven't seen that population boom that the eastern and western coasts and especially the larger cities have seen. There just aren't the jobs to keep the young people in the small communities in agricultural regions.
So when you hear about the country hitting 300 million, heading toward 400 million, does that look like a good thing to you that may at some point repopulate the streets of Hettinger, or just it occurs in an alternate universe that doesn't matter to you in North Dakota?
Well, I think it's a little bit of both. We definitely see slowly some interest from people that grew up in rural areas wanting to come back to live in a small town, be it in retirement or maybe when their kids are going into school, they want to be in a smaller town. So I don't know if it's necessarily tied to population growth as much as it is as a desire for people that have left the small towns to come back to them at some point. They're not rushing back, but we occasionally will see some instances where population does start to at least stabilize and not continue to shrink as some of these people come back looking for that quality of life that they grew up with.
Martha Farnsworth-Ritchie, do you see this growing population as it heads toward 400 million next spreading out across the country or just more piling up on the coasts, the south, the west?
It depends on how attractive life on the coast continues to be relative to places like Hettinger, North Dakota. Someone asked me after the 1990 census why population was still growing so much in California, because it wasn't as nice as it used to be before all these people came. And I said, it'll keep growing as long as California is nice relative to other parts of the country. Part of what will determine that is whether people have to bear the costs of more congestion. They already do, as one caller said earlier, in terms of more congestion driving. There are other costs, as Victoria Markham has mentioned, in terms of resource use. And as William Fry has mentioned, there are costs in terms of just the unattractiveness of sprawl, and of course that's why many of us have preferred to move back to these small towns once we don't have to worry about jobs. So there are all those costs, and we can change those cost equations through public policy, and that is really what I think we need to think about. That's why a milestone like 300 million is good, because it forces us to think about where we're going and do we need to make some changes.
Where do we need that population to be? Chris Showers in North Dakota, thanks very much for being with us. Let me take a call from Roanoke, Virginia. Raleigh's on the air. Hi, Raleigh.
Yes, Tom, I just, the interesting point is on the, all of the issues being discussed, if we pose the question, the particular interest that the new immigrant population will have, how it varies today from the interests of the immigrant population that we had that in the past.
Now, what do you mean by that? I assume people want, you know, they want a house, they want a family, they want a car. Won't they want what Americans have always wanted?
Well, how will we address that in terms of groups that we have today, the fringe, the say, for instance, LULAC and these groups that are trying to assimilate in their own way other than the quote-unquote the Americanization and the assimilation of the Americanization of the immigrant.
I want to be sure I understand. Are you saying you're concerned as we pass 300, go toward 400, that the character of the country will change?
Well, I noticed that the gentleman that called and referred to the quality of the social and economic impact,
yes,
and the quality that it has, was not addressed by the fellow that I believe from the Brookings Institute or the visiting university. I found that interesting because we are to pose this question in intellectual honesty. We have got to address the educational, I believe, primarily the educational and criminal justice impact of what we've seen in the past.
Well, Martha spoke to that, Raleigh, and her observation was that a century ago, when there were Italians and Greeks and even Germans coming, those were unsettling populations for a lot of Americans. Do you think there's reason to think, Raleigh, that the Hispanic influx will not be assimilated like that influx a century ago?
It may well be, but it's a completely different mindset. They're coming here for it's a much more myopic view they have of this country, and as far as because it's borne out in the fact that Mexico is craving the billions of dollars being sent back that's earned here.
Yeah, they need the money, that's for sure. Of course, people long have. Raleigh, thanks for your call. Martha, what do you say to that perspective?
Well, you know, people were making the same argument in relation to Italians 100 years ago. And certainly the Italian educational level and value for education with the poor Italians who came largely from the south of Italy was very parallel to what we're seeing with the Hispanics who are coming in now. Remittances were a tremendously important issue for Italy with all the immigrants who were here. And what isn't recognized is that a large proportion of those Italian immigrants eventually went back after they'd earned the money to buy the little farm. I think it was a quarter or a third of them who returned, and, of course, we're seeing a lot of return migration in Mexico, too. So I would challenge the idea there's something different about today's immigrants. I would say, instead, there might be something different about our policy response. In the last wave 100 years ago, we had a lot of Americanization programs where we, at public expense, taught people English, taught them our history. We're really not doing that this way now, and that is making things a little different, particularly because the Hispanic immigrants, although they come from many countries, they all speak the same language, unlike the Greeks who spoke Greek, the Italians who spoke Italian, and the Poles who came in with them who spoke Polish. So I guess I would say that what's different is our policy response.
Let me get one more call from Spokane, Washington. Bob's on the line. Hi, Bob, you're on the air.
Yeah, it seems like the topic, I know your time's short, got a little derailed on the 400 million number, or the 300 million number now, 400 million before my time comes to pass. And I just think that people need to open the window and take a look outside. I mean, we're talking about injecting sulfur compounds into the upper atmosphere to counteract global warming.
Yeah.
We got an issue, whether it's just because you live in a rural area and you can't see the change, or you live in some major metropolitan area and you're gridlocked all
the
time.
What would you do about it, Bob? Would you change the birth rate, the immigration policy, or the environmental policy, or all?
We're either going to change it or it's going to get changed. You know, we don't get that option. We're either going to elect now to limit it to one kid or no kids, or Mother Nature is going to change it for us.
Let us pick it up. Our time is short. Victoria, how about it? I mean, are Americans going to like the country they live in at 400 million?
Well, Tom, what I would like to interject is I think you can't underestimate the per-person resource use in terms of the impact. So I think it's not always just in terms of the numbers of people that equates with environmental impact. It depends on the decisions made about the way the land is developed, the way if you use energy-efficient transport or, you know, the method of agriculture, organic or not, or industry used, if it's polluting or not.
But do you see trend lines that suggest to you optimism about those things improving so that the impact on the land is less?
Yeah, absolutely. As people become more informed, and this 300 million mark helps us to be able to take a look at that with renewed interest. Yes, I mean, I think we know far more now about the environmental impacts of each person. We've got the science. The science is out there now. And I think we can present this to our policymakers to have adequate policy responses. I think that's clear. And our nation is changing, and I think the policy has to change with it.
Well, there's a rosy view. William Fry, when you look out and think about that 300, next 400 million, do you think you're going to like it?
I think I will. I don't know if I'll be here then. But I think what will happen is we will make gradual changes. I mean, the nice thing is to focus on this number, 300 million, so that we can think about what it means in all these different arenas. But changes occur gradually, and we don't need to be scared about them. We just have to be aware of them.
Well, we're trying to be aware right now, but it sure sounds like a heads-up moment to me. I want to thank each of you for being with us in this hour. William Fry, joining us from the University of Michigan. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Sure, I enjoyed it.
Martha Farnsworth Ritchie at Cornell, former director of the U.S. Census Bureau. Martha, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
And Victoria Markham, at the director of the Center for Environment and Population. Victoria, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, it was a pleasure.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.